as far as your written work goes, in the workbook, pages 1 through 6, and the test on page 101, I forgot to go over the test with you yesterday, so we'll do that today. And then, since today is Wednesday, you should have also read chapter 3 in Logic and the book of 1 Corinthians and the workbook, pages 11 through 17, and the tests on page 103 to 105. And I hope you are keeping up with your reading as well as your written assignment, because it will be much clearer to you if you don't just hear it from me, if you read the text in the workbook as well. Repetition is very helpful in understanding new ideas and new concepts. Now, before we get into reviewing the homework for today, I don't know how many of you follow the Simpson trial. I've probably seen more of it this week than I have before. But yesterday, the prosecution presented a dilemma for the defense. Is anybody aware of what the dilemma was? We were talking about dilemmas yesterday a little bit. Does anybody recall what the dilemma was that they've done? Well, let me briefly explain it then. They showed a videotape, not the videotape of Simpson exercising, but the videotape of Simpson making a speech. And in the speech, he's pushing a product called Juice Plus or something of that sort, which he says cured him of his arthritis. Now, his defense in court, his lawyers have been arguing that his arthritis so crippled him that he was physically incapable of committing the murders. So this is the dilemma. The dilemma is, if he's telling the truth on the tape, his lawyers are lying in court. If he's not telling the truth on the tape, he's lying on the tape, and why should we trust him now? And the tapes were shown. To my understanding, the defense wanted to show just the completed videotape, the prosecution wanted to show just the completed videotape, but the defense insisted on all the outtakes, all the parts that were edited out as well, so the jury would see the whole thing. And all of the things that came up, or many of the things, not all of the things, but many of the things that came up were in some of the outtakes as well. But there you have a dilemma, and it's as timely as anybody could ask for in a logic class to have this going on nationwide TV. And it's left the defense in bad shape because of the force of that dilemma. Either his lawyers are lying now, or he was lying on the videotape and therefore should not be trusted. Well, with that in mind, let's go on with the review of the homework here. If you'll turn to your workbook, we went over page 12 yesterday. So let's start with page 13, exercise 2.1, and do these questions. And if you know the answer, raise your hand and call it out so everybody can hear it. The first one, when a single word has two or more meanings, we call it, any hands? Yes, sir. Okay, we call it an equivocation. Two, when a phrase has two or more meanings, it is, yes, in the back, an amphibology. Blank occurs when words or phrases in a statement are emphasized or stressed, producing quite different meanings than the original. Yes. Accent, the fallacy of accent. The fallacy of blank occurs when one reasons fallaciously from the characteristics of the components to the characteristics of the compound or whole. What is that fallacy? Yes, sir. Composition, that's I. Blank means that one of the premises from which the conclusion is deduced is the conclusion itself, perhaps disguised in form. What is that Latin phrase that means that? Yes. K. A good Latin letter. Petitio principii. The blank fallacy occurs when one appeals to the character, the situation, the beliefs or prejudices of the person to be convinced, instead of arguing from premises that pertain to the subject under discussion. What would that be? Appealing to the, yes, the abusive ad hominem E. If pity is appealed to for the sake of getting a conclusion accepted, this is called blank, since such a plea is not a proof of anything. Yes, in the back? Very good. F, it's the appeal to pity, ad misericordiam. 8, blank appeals are attempts to win approval or popular assent to a conclusion by arousing the feelings or emotions of the crowd. In the back? Ad populum, G. Number 9, blank occurs when one treats a statement having a plurality of questions or assumptions as if it required nothing more than a single simple answer. Yes, complex question. That's H. The fallacy blank is committed when one claims that what is first temporally is necessarily the cause of what follows. Okay, what is it? Okay. That they only put the first half of that name in there, post hoc ergo propter hoc. 11, D occurs when one appeals to force. You know that one in the back. Or the threat of force to gain acceptance of a conclusion. Some people were looking at me menacingly up here. Blank occurs when an attempt is made to use some accidental or irrelevant factor as the essential point of an argument. Accident, the fallacy of accident. Remember the story about the stork. Any questions on that exercise? And it's conceivable that somebody could have a slightly different answer from these if a fallacy can be classified, or a particular instance can be classified as two different fallacies. Let's go on with the exercise 2.2. Number 1, one word in the slogan "save soap and waste paper" is an example of which informal fallacy? Yes, sir. Equivocation, J. Which word is it? Waste. Depends on whether it's a verb or an adjective. Good steaks, number 2. Good steaks are rare these days, therefore don't order yours well done. Which letter? Yes. Equivocation and the word? Rare. Okay. Number 3. Now there might be some differing opinions on this one. Do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. You would like others to give you cocaine, therefore you ought to give me some cocaine. This is an example out of the textbook. What fallacy is being committed here? Yes. Amphibology C. That's a good answer. Any other possible answers? Anybody see any other possible answers? Well, if everybody agrees, that's fine. We won't cross-classify it then. How about 4? The original. I am not going to take you to the zoo because it is Saturday. Another version of the original. I am not going to take you to the zoo because it's Saturday. What's the fallacy here? Yes. Accent, letter A. 5, our team is composed of the best football players in the state. Therefore, it is the best team in the state. What's the fallacy? Yes. Composition, I. It doesn't follow. I think Clark used that example in the text. Now, the team, they may all be stars, but they may all be prima donnas and not get along with each other. And when you put them on the same court, the whole team might fall apart. Number 6, chlorine is a poison and so is sodium. Therefore, if you combine them to get the compound NaCl, sodium chloride, it is twice the poison of the components. Yes. Composition again. The characteristics of the whole are not necessarily the characteristics of the components or the parts. Look at number 7. Now, these are statements from Thomas Aquinas, one of his proofs for the existence of God. Whatever is moved must be moved by another. If that by which it is moved be itself moved, then this also must be moved by another, and that by another again. But this cannot go on to infinity. Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at the first mover, moved by no other, and this everyone understands to be God. Any ideas on the fallacies involved here? Yes, sir. Okay, begging the question. Can anybody explain how the question is begged in this argument? What is begging the question to begin with? Does anybody recall? Okay, using the conclusion as one of the premises. How does that occur in this argument? Whatever is moved must be moved by another? Well, I don't see that. I don't think that's the same as the conclusion, because the conclusion is there must be a first mover moved by no other. Any other comments? Where does that appear? Where does the conclusion appear in disguised form as a premise? Right. In the phrase, it cannot go on to infinity. That's where it appears. It's disguised there. But that's where the conclusion appears as a premise. It cannot go on to infinity. And the argument becomes a form of begging the question. Someone may also argue, and I'll give you an alternative in this case, that J is a proper answer. Does anyone have J for 7? On the word move. That takes a little bit more knowledge of Thomas's philosophy, but if you know a little bit about it, he's equivocating. He's using the word move in two different senses. In the first sense, it's physical motion in the premises. Whatever is moved must be moved by another. But the first mover, of course, can't engage in physical motion. So we're equivocating on the word move. So there are two possible answers to that one. Let's look at number 8. No wonder you think protective tariffs are good for the country. You're a manufacturer, aren't you? Which one is that? I'm sorry? Which letter? Okay, it's just listed as ad hominem. It should be abusive ad hominem. Number 9, judge, if you sentence me to a long prison term, my wife and children will be homeless within a short time. Who will care for them? Yes. Okay, the appeal to pity. What letter is it? F. The appeal to pity. And it might be worth your time sometime to spend a day in a courtroom, even if it's just traffic court, and listen to the appeals to pity that go on. Number 10, some claim that Christian schools are guilty of race discrimination because they were organized just after the laws against discrimination were enacted. Which fallacy? Yes. L. Okay, false cause. The IRS in particular has argued this way, that because Christian school movements started in the 60s and 70s, when the desegregation laws were coming into effect, that somehow Christian schools aren't entitled to tax-exempt status. Number 11, having failed to convince the worker to vote for unionization, he is told, join up or else. What is that? Yes, sir? D, the appeal to the stick. It is good to help your fellow man, isn't it? Number 12, I'm having a terrible time with this examination, so help me by giving me your answers to the question. What's the fallacy here? Yes, sir? C. What is C? Amphibology? What is the phrase that's ambiguous? Yes?
Let's say good to help your fellow man, and that would be a question.
Okay.
Yes.
I think that's right. Anybody have any other answer besides C? Yes, I think that would be acceptable. Help your fellow man, or help. After all, this student is your fellow man here. Look at 13. Have you noticed that every recession is preceded by bank failures? Therefore, the bankers are the source of our problems and troubles. What's that? L. Very good. L is the answer. Post hoc. The secret of success on the job is simple. Just fall in love with your job, then success will follow inevitably. What's that one? L again. Number 15, the only reason you oppose the draft is because you are eligible for it and you are afraid of being drafted. Yes, in the back. Which letter?
E.
The abusive ad hominem, it should be there. The author of this work, number 16, was charged with more than a few atrocious crimes. Therefore, the book is not worth much. Yes. E. Ad hominem. Abusive ad hominem. K. All explanation. I'm sorry. Here we go again. All explanations as to why there is widespread unemployment reduced to this. The reason there is unemployment is that people are out of work. And obviously that's begging the question. Every tuft in a bale of cotton when dropped from a height of 20 feet makes no audible noise. It follows that a bale of cotton would make no noise if it were dropped from a height of 20 feet. Yes, sir. Composition again. 19, this argument is fallacious. I know it is fallacious because it is not valid. It is not valid because it contains a fallacy. What's wrong with that argument? What are we doing there? Okay, begging the question again. 20, when will you stop procrastinating and make your decision for Christ? Yes, sir? H, complex question. 21, since the fast horse is tied fast and this horse is tied fast, it follows that this horse is fast. Any ideas? Yes, sir? Equivocation. And what's the word? Fast. Okay, 22, a McBurger is better than nothing. Nothing is better than a homemade Thanksgiving dinner. Therefore, a McBurger is better than a homemade Thanksgiving dinner. Yes, sir? Okay. Equivocation on which word? Number 23, the newspaper reported that the gangster blew out his brains after taking affectionate farewell of his family with a shotgun. I'm sorry? D. No, not really. Any other ideas on that one? What is C? Amphibology? Yes, there's certainly an ambiguous phrase in there. Another possibility, although it may not be so obvious, is accent. If this is reported by someone reading orally on television or radio, they may put in some punctuation that may make it sound different. 24, you are saved the moment after you make a decision for Jesus Christ by signing this card. Everybody does it this way. Which one? Yes, sir? G. Okay, ad populum. Okay, let's turn over to the tests at the rear. And since we didn't do test one yesterday, we'll have to do all of them today, up to page 105. Number one, an argument refers to any altercation between persons. That's obviously false. An argument in logic is not an altercation. Number two, in geometry, the theorems are axioms which have been proved true. That is false as well. It's confusing theorems and axioms. Number three, necessary inference is the relation that holds between premises and a conclusion in a valid argument. True or false? Necessary inference is the relation that holds between premises and a conclusion in a valid argument. That's true. Number four, any enthymeme is valid once expanded to a complete argument. That's false. Number five, an argument may be valid, containing no fallacy, yet contain false premises. I'm sorry? True, I heard. Very good. Number six, the statement Esther made 95% on the test, so she received an A, assumes that all students who made 95% on the test received an A. Is that true or false? That's true. Seven, from all animals have four legs and all things with four legs are bad, we can validly conclude that all bad things are animals. That's false. Number eight, Clark does not believe that theology must necessarily use valid arguments. False. Number nine, for Clark, getting into an argument with someone may not involve argument. That's true. Number 10, logic provides rules that will aid us in discovering ambiguities in language. That's false. English does, and grammar does, but not logic. Yes? All animals have four legs. All things with four legs are bad. Therefore, all animals are bad. You can't change the order of the subject and the predicate in that form of argument and have it remain valid. And what the author has done here is reversed the subject and predicate. Instead of saying all animals are bad, he says all bad things are animals. We'll cover that in a little bit. Six, go ahead.
Yeah, it seems to me that in order to make that correct, could be made that the assumption is that 95% of sufficient DNA, not that other students, it's almost irrelevant that other students may have gotten A's at 95%. What was really assumed was that 95% was the cutoff for an A.
That's true, but it's the same proposition. If there are other students, then they had to make 95%. I think we're quibbling about semantics at this point. Look at test 2 on page 103. Number 1, arguments are invalid only when they contain an informal fallacy. Yes, in the back?
False.
They can have formal fallacies as well. Number 2, informal fallacies are mainly bad English. Unless, of course, you speak Spanish, then they're bad Spanish. Number 3, equivocation and amphibology are synonymous, strictly having the identical meaning. Anyone?
False.
Okay. Number 4, in the question, what is the chief end of man? The word end has two meanings. That's a tricky one. Clark gives the example of the student who misunderstands it and thinks that end means something besides purpose. But certainly the way the question was formulated by the Westminster theologians, it has only one meaning. Number 5, classification of informal fallacies is systematic, meaning that there is none that overlaps classes. False. It's not systematic. Number 6, liberal theologians often use either equivocation or amphibology to undermine biblical doctrines. True. Clark spends a couple pages on the subject. Number 7, the qualities of wholes are not necessarily the qualities of the components. True. Number 8, the word move in English can mean to put something else in motion, or it can mean to be in motion. True. Number 9, begging the question is actually valid, but useless as a proof to convince anyone. True. Ignoratio elenchi is translated irrelevant conclusion. That's false. Yes, sir? Number 2?
The informal fallacy of many bad English.
Yes.
What about like abusive ad hominems and ad hominems? Aren't those informal fallacies?
Those are informal fallacies. The escape word there is mainly.
Yeah.
Number 11, let's name the fallacy here. Say what you will, I'm not going to let a black cat cross my path. John let one cross his path, and shortly thereafter his house caught on fire. Somebody give me the answer? C. Now, if anything is good for an outstanding industry, such as the automobile industry, then it will be good for the country as a whole. A, composition. In fact, it was a Secretary of Treasury or Secretary of Commerce back in the 1950s that made that very statement. Only he put it in the phrase, what's good for General Motors is good for America. The witness's statement cannot be reliable, for the record shows that he participated in protest demonstrations against the president's policy in Vietnam while he was in college. A, abusive ad hominem. A person's strongest motives determine his actions, for if we wish to determine which of a person's motives are strongest, we need only examine which of the alternative courses of action he chooses to do. C, begging the question. You've simply restated your premise as the conclusion. Number 15, a man steps on a grave by mistake and subsequently claims he became sickened to death. Yes? D, post hoc. 16, a man in his late teens found guilty of the brutal murder of his parents pleaded for mercy on the grounds that he was now a poor, penniless orphan. C, appeal to pity. Why should we work our fingers bare to fatten the already bloated pockets of members of the House of Representatives? D, complex question. The end of a thing is its perfection. Death is the end of life, therefore death is the perfection of life. Which one is that? Well, we have A and B. Let's have an argument for both sides. Who says A? And what is the phrase? Yes. That would be the phrase you're saying is equivocal. It's not used twice there, though. The only thing used twice is the word perfection. I think it should be B. 19, I feel certain the workers' union will be reasonable about the matter of losing. After all, man is a rational animal. Yes. A, accident. I'm sorry, accident. A, I feel certain the workers' union will be reasonable about the matter of losing. After all, man is a rational animal. Those are the tests that you should have done up till now. Please keep up with your homework.
I have one question about the 18. On the equivocation there, I assume the equivocation has to do with the word "and," correct?
Let me check here a second. Yes. I'm not sure I understand the question. It could be either one, depending on the situation. If you're saying that the Jews are responsible for this disaster, or that might be a post hoc, or if you're saying you're maligning the character of Jews as a race and saying that therefore they must be the cause of this disaster, that would certainly be abusive ad hominem. It just depends on how the whole argument is presented. It could be either one, either post hoc or abusive. Any other questions? Yes, in the back. Ignorance of the refutation, I believe it is. Where is this now? Oh, number 10. Yes, I think it's ignorance of the refutation rather than irrelevant conclusion. Refutation. Yes. Any other questions on any of the written work? Well, let's go on then and begin talking about definition. This is chapter 3 in the book. Clark makes the point that the presence of equivocation, the presence of several meanings for words, shows the necessity for clear and precise definitions, especially in theology. Now, there is at least one theologian writing today, and if I can put my finger on a quote from him, I'll give it to you immediately, who says that that is not the case. We don't need clear and precise definitions when we do theology. And he teaches up in Philadelphia. He's talking about the technical terms that he uses in one of his books. And certainly if you're going to use technical terms, they ought to have a strict and precise definition. But he says that they have a good deal of vagueness and imprecision about them, and that my definition should be read sympathetically and not pressed for precision. And he denies the necessity of defining your terms clearly. Now, it's obvious that any word that you might look up in the dictionary, whether it be cat or dog or mountain or whatever it might be, you're going to find several definitions of that word. Think of the word lap, for example. Well, a lap can mean what appears when you sit down, disappears when you stand up. A lap can mean a turn around a track. A completely different meaning. A lap around the track. It can act as a verb rather than a noun. He lapped him. That is, he did a lap faster than the other fellow and was now a lap ahead. Yes, yes, a dog lapping up water. So if you look in a dictionary and under for the word lap and you see at least three different meanings for it, don't think that logic insists that a word be used in one meaning. In ordinary language, we use words in several meanings. What logic insists and what the rules of logic insist on is that in an argument, the word lap or whatever the word might be has to be used consistently in the same sense. If you use the word lap as what appears when you sit down in the premise, you can't use the word lap as a turn around the track in the conclusion. That word has to bear one meaning throughout the argument, from beginning to end. If there's any change in meaning, it's equivocation. And this is very important. And those terms have to be strictly adhered to, those definitions. Pascal, as Clark mentions here, and Pascal was a Christian thinker, a Frenchman, who said that if you're in any doubt as to definitions, you substitute the definition in your mind for the term being defined. And use that as a very good rule, especially if you're reading a text in whatever subject, and you come across a word that is unfamiliar to you, look it up in the dictionary, and then plug in the meaning in the text itself as you read. And that will help you very much in understanding what you read, and it will certainly help you in formulating logical arguments. Now, Clark distinguishes between two types of definitions, connotative and denotative. Can anybody tell me the difference between those two from your reading? Yes, sir. Okay, a set of rules. Okay, a denotative definition lists the examples. What would be a connotative definition of a citizen or a resident of Portland or Vancouver? What would be a connotative definition of the phrase Vancouver resident? Must have lived where? Okay. A Vancouver resident is a person who has lived in Vancouver for 1 year or within certain specific boundaries for 1 year. Now, what would be a denotative definition of a Vancouver resident? Yes, sir? Okay, it would be a list of all their names. Perhaps the telephone book would be a denotative definition of the phrase Vancouver resident. A connotative definition is a phrase which gives certain qualifications or certain rules. A person who lives within a certain geographical boundary. It's very important to keep those distinctions in mind. Clark says you might say that the word definition is equivocal because there are at least two possible ways that you can understand a definition. It's either connotative or denotative. You'll find a discussion of all this beginning on page 22 in the textbook. He points out that there's an interesting relationship between the two. The relationship is as the number of qualifications or rules increases in the connotative definition, the number of names or instances tends to decrease in the denotative definition, and vice versa. So if you add to your connotative definition of Vancouver resident, not just the fact that they live within certain boundaries, but they must have lived here for a year, your list will be shorter than the first list. If you increase it to those people must be over 18 years old, it will be shorter still. So there tends to be this relationship between the two, but he says it's not a strict relationship. On the top of page 23, he points out, and the instance he gives is qualified voters. That's the example he gives. It's not a strict relationship because conceivably there can be some play, as it were, or some leeway in there. He also gives the relationship between prime numbers and numbers. Are there any mathematicians present? Maybe they can explain why there are as many prime numbers as there are numbers. Yes, sir. What does infinite mean? Or what does infinity mean? Okay, never ending. There's always one more. Never ending. Clark makes the point that the relationship between connotative and denotative is important because a denotative definition depends on a connotative definition. And the example he gives of this is miracles. What is a miracle? And he talks about the crossing of the Red Sea. David Hume maintained that a miracle was a violation of the law of nature. And some scientists say the same thing today. To which a Christian, as Clark does, might reply, well, at the crossing of the Red Sea, it was a strong east wind that blew the waters back, and there was no violation of any laws of nature. Yet this is a miracle. David Hume would say it's a coincidence, if it happened at all.